Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Engine running.
Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discovery,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology,
unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is the Naked Scientists. Hello, welcome to this week's Naked Scientists. This is the program that brings you the latest breakthroughs in science, technology, and medicine. And I'm Chris Smith. And today we're revisiting long COVID. Almost 2 million people in the UK are estimated to be living with the condition. So are we any closer to finding out what is causing their debilitating symptoms?
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is the Naked Scientists.
Four years ago, the World Health Organization officially recognized COVID-19 as a pandemic. Since then, we've seen the development of effective tests and treatments and billions of vaccinations administered, which have reined in the disease and turned what was formerly a death sentence for some into a mild infection for the vast majority. But while the global health emergency acutely is over, the aftershocks of the infections are still very much reverberating around us in societal and economic terms, and also in post-infection syndromes that are hitting some people. In the UK alone, an estimated 2 million people are suffering from long-term symptoms that last at least 4 weeks after their first infection with SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID, and some have now been living with these problems for years. This is known as long COVID, and today we're bringing you the latest developments in our understanding of its pernicious and puzzling presentations. Sarah Taylor is a university lecturer who first caught COVID in early 2022 when the Omicron wave of the virus was at its peak.
The headache lasted for months, and then other symptoms appeared. Stiffness, getting up and down a staircase was a sheer act of will, because I was like the Tin Man, just couldn't really bend my legs. The biggest issue, though, was cognition. Spatial reasoning is particularly problematic. I go to chair-based yoga and I can only do half the session because I just get so exhausted. But I'm not just getting physically exhausted. The lady is telling me where to put my hands. And as time progresses, I get more and more confused and lose the ability to sort of coordinate my hands, and the brain fog starts kicking in. So it's actually the brain fog more than the physical that is why I only do half the session. The ability to think is part and parcel of my job. And in the first few months after getting COVID, I couldn't think. I couldn't process information, words. I was on sick leave for a year. Some days a text message would be a few words. I couldn't write anything that made sense, and I couldn't speak to make sense either. When I got referred to the long COVID clinic, I got a swallow test and all that kind of thing, which was very useful because swallowing was an issue and that has now been largely resolved. But no one really worked with me on my cognition and the sort of speech issues.
Sarah Taylor, whose experience may well be familiar to many. Now, while many with long COVID, like Sarah, have reported neurological symptoms, including brain fog, there has, until recently, been no objective measurement of how severely people are really affected. That was until a new study from Imperial College London, recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found that people experiencing long COVID saw cognitive deficits equivalent to a loss of 6 points of IQ. I've been speaking to the lead author on the study, Adam Hampshire.
We built on the back of one of the largest epidemiological studies that was run in the UK during the pandemic. It was called REACT, which is the real-time assessment of community transmission. And that was a project where they sampled somewhere in the order of about 3.5 million people randomly within the general population to see at different points in the pandemic whether they had been infected with the virus and whether they had COVID or not. So we've kind of got this background on people's history of COVID, if you like. And what we did is we recontacted 800,000 of them and asked them to take part in an online cognitive assessment on a platform that's called Cognitron that can measure different aspects of cognitive and memory ability through people's laptops, their smartphones. And out of those people we contacted, there's about 140,000 did at least one of our tests, and about 112,000 completed the entire assessment.
How big are the differences that you're detecting? So if I took an IQ test, for example, and I was affected in the way that some of the people you registered in the study were affected, how many IQ points down would I effectively be if I were affected in that way?
If we treat the global score from this assessment like an IQ test, then the group with the largest cognitive deficit is, on average, people who were in intensive care. And so they show a difference of around about -9 IQ points. People who have ongoing persistent symptoms, that is the ones who may have long COVID, they perform at about -6 IQ points. And that's enough that it could affect your daily function. You're very likely to be aware and notice that change. The larger number of people, of course, sit in the short-term symptom group, and they show a difference on average of about -3 IQ points, and that's very small. But we are powered, we're able to detect that because we measured so many people.
Were there any things that leapt out in people who got SARS-CoV-2 infection where certain elements of cognition were consistently impacted, or is it just an across-the-board reduction for at least a period of time in everybody?
In terms of aspects of cognitive ability, we saw the strongest relationships with having had COVID-19 in memory function, reasoning, and what we call executive function, things like planning. That's the case if we were looking at, for example, people who had longer-term sort of ongoing persistent symptoms, so what some people would refer to as long COVID.
And critically, when a person says they get better, because we know that a proportion of people have symptoms for a certain period of time and then they get better. When they get better, does their cognition go back to normal, do you think?
We have to be very careful here in terms of the inferences that we draw. What we're looking at are essentially associations. We're not looking at change because we have only measured one time point. Nonetheless, the pattern of results that we see shows that people who have ongoing persistent symptoms, they perform worse than people who had shorter duration symptoms. Whilst that's the case, even people who had short duration symptoms on average showed slightly worse cognitive performance compared to people who had not had COVID at all. The really interesting group are people who had ongoing persistent symptoms, but by the time we cognitively tested them, those had resolved. That set of participants performed at the same level as people who had only short-term persistent symptoms. That is, only a small cognitive deficit was still evident.
Well, that's slightly encouraging, isn't it? Because it, notwithstanding the fact that this is an association, would argue that there should be an improvement in someone when their symptoms overall subside.
Exactly. I think on the face of it, our study has some results that were quite negative and not really what we hoped to see. For example, that we see any association between shorter duration COVID and cognition, and that's somewhat worrisome. It's not what we were looking for. We didn't predict that. On the other hand, it does appear to be the case that people who have long-term persistent symptoms, when those symptoms eventually subside, they may well have some degree of recovery in their cognitive and memory abilities. Another really quite promising result that we had was that actually several of the results in the study converged towards indicating that this association between COVID and cognition has reduced throughout the pandemic. So the association was larger for the original virus and for the alpha variant, but by the time we get to Omicron, it seems to have been diminished.
To what do you attribute that? Do you think that's because by that time it's hitting people who've been either infected before and recovered or vaccinated before and are therefore subject to a less severe infection?
Well, our model takes all of these things into account, but they're quite hard to disentangle because they correlate across time. So, of course, if you think through the course of the pandemic, different virus variants were dominant, right? And then in addition to that, partway through, they started to roll out vaccinations and approaches to treatments probably improved somewhat as well. Within the model, it would appear to be the case that if a person was vaccinated at least twice prior to their infection, they have a small cognitive advantage relative to people who had not yet been vaccinated. So I think that's one aspect that's probably coming into play. And it's very likely that later variants had a lesser impact on cognition as well. So these things aren't mutually exclusive.
Imperial College's Adam Hampshire. You're listening to The Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith, and this week we're looking at long COVID. Shortly, we'll hear how the immune system might be driving some of the most common signs and symptoms of this illness among those who have the condition. But first, while the robust evidence that infection with COVID can, as Adam Hampshire was just telling us, lead to a significant reduction in cognitive ability, it's still just a part of the overall picture when it comes to what we've come to term long COVID. Natalie McDermott is a paediatric infectious diseases doctor from King's College London. For her, the aftermath of what was at the time quite a mild case of COVID has been significant, disabling and quite different from some of the other things we've heard about so far.
I was working on the front line during the pandemic. I started at Great Ormond Street in March of 2020 and I contracted COVID probably by the end of March of 2020, fully recovered from that, went back to work, and then at the end of May 2020 I seemed to get an almost identical illness again, and following on from that illness I developed nerve pain in my feet, and then that seemed to progress to other neurological symptoms and problems walking.
I knew you straight away because I was watching you on the television at the start of the pandemic. You were a fit, healthy young woman by the look of it. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. In fact, I think not even 2 years before, I'd just returned from a massive fieldwork study in Sierra Leone. I used to walk 4 miles a day. I would run regularly.
And we've just walked into this office together and you're using crutches. And it's 4 years since you contracted COVID, you think?
Yes, so I've been using the crutches for probably about a little over 3.5 years now, and I wouldn't say that my symptoms have really improved during that time. I think my ability to manage them and deal with them has improved, but the symptoms themselves are pretty much the same.
You say you get some nerve pain and some other neurological symptoms, so tell us what your life is like then now. What's actually happening to you?
I find it difficult to walk. Lifting my feet off the ground is what's the biggest challenge. So at least with the crutches, I can kind of use my arms to propel my legs a bit more. But I need crutches to go, you know, a few hundred metres. And anything beyond that, I generally use a mobility scooter to get around. But it also affects my bladder and my bowel and leaves me with constant pain in my legs and my feet.
Is it getting worse, getting better?
Well, it's not clear at the moment. It's not getting better that I can tell. And I had some investigations recently which suggest maybe there's been a slight worsening, but I'm not sure yet.
One thing that people often say to me is that it's really hard to get support, to see somebody who can listen to them, to find out about their symptoms, offer solutions to manage their problems they're having better. Is that improving, or is there still a black hole for people who find themselves in a bad state post-COVID?
I think there's some improvement in people being more understanding of the condition and trying to support people in their recovery. But the problem is, I think we don't have any solutions. So while there might be people to see in a clinic environment, so healthcare workers that might assess you, I think there's still long waits for that. But there are people who will assess you and have a bit better understanding of the symptoms. We don't have any answers out as to how to manage that other than take things easy and pacing and so on. And obviously that does work for some people. Some people have fully recovered, but we tend to see that in people who got COVID later on, and they tend to show signs of recovery within the first year and more or less a complete recovery within the first 12 to 18 months. For those of us who had COVID at the very beginning and have not really shown any signs of recovery 3.5 years in, we just don't know what the outcome is for that, because if you haven't improved in 3.5 years, is something magically going to change overnight that your body just suddenly says, oh, now I'll recover? I think we want to believe that, but I can understand the desperation for various treatments and people trying different things, even though there's no good evidence to suggest they work.
A powerful story, isn't it? Natalie McDermott there. We'll hear more from Natalie a bit later on in the programme. So the question is, why has this happened to some people? Given the broad range of symptoms, from brain fog to fatigue, muscle pains and signs of nerve damage, it's likely that long COVID is not one single condition, but an umbrella term that unites a host of different syndromes, all with different mechanisms, outcomes and best treatments. I went to see Cambridge University virologist Ben Krishna, who branched out into working on long COVID during the pandemic. He agrees that long COVID can be an unhelpful term.
So the problem with the terminology of long COVID is just that it's a very broad and umbrella term. You can imagine three different people. You've had one person who was very, very sick with COVID-19 in 2020. They went into hospital, they were put on oxygen, they were given what we call mechanical ventilation. So they essentially had a tube put into their lungs, and then their lungs were inflated artificially for a certain amount of time. And then eventually they've recovered and they've been discharged from the hospital. And you're thinking 6 months later, are they feeling back to where they were before COVID-19? The answer is probably no. But is that really long COVID, or is that really just them slowly recovering from the initial infection? You then have person two, they lost their taste and smell. That hasn't come back for whatever reason. I don't think we exactly know what causes that yet. But for whatever reason, they can't go to restaurants. But at the same time, they can go into work and they can do everything they normally do. It's just a taste and smell that's gone. And the third case, and these are perhaps, in my opinion, the strangest cases, where somebody got sick with COVID-19. They had the similar symptoms that a lot of people are familiar with. So they were in bed and feeling fatigued, and most people got better and they went back to their normal lives. And for these people, they just didn't get better. And in some cases, it's been a year, it's been sometimes 2 years, and these people still feel like the first early days of a viral infection, and they just never recovered.
What do we think the underlying mechanisms of cases like that latter one might be?
So it's still quite controversial what might be causing it. There is a growing body of evidence that the immune system switches on and then fails to switch off. What exactly is causing that is not entirely clear. It could be, for example, that people got infected with the virus. The virus has infected some part of their body and is still there at a very low level and is just continually making small amounts of virus. And as a result of this, their immune system is still on and still fighting the virus, and that's what's making them feel sick. Because we know that a lot of what really makes you feel sick when you've got a virus is actually the immune system's response fighting the virus, not the virus itself. Alternatively, it could be something autoimmune. So it could be that the immune system started off fighting the virus and now it's mistakenly started attacking a part of the body that it's not supposed to. And actually, a lot of long COVID does look a bit like autoimmunity. Particularly, many patients say they have cycles of symptoms, so they get better and then they get worse and they get better again. Or finally, it could be something that we're just not aware of right now. It could be that the immune system is switched on, it's not switching off, and it's for some reason that we just don't know about yet.
How are you trying to get underneath that and find out which of those, or whether it's all of them, are behind this?
Our research suggested that the immune system had switched on in people who had COVID-19, and in most people it switched off. But in this small group of patients with long COVID, it just was still switched on. And it was particularly switched on, it was making one particular protein. This protein is called interferon gamma, and it is known to make you feel quite sick. We tried looking for virus in these patients. So what we did was we took blood samples from these patients and then we just looked for signs that the virus was still there. We didn't find anything in the patient's blood. We were particularly interested in their intestines. So there's some data out there showing that patients continue harboring the virus in their intestines and it comes out in their poo. That is actually where we're moving at the moment, is trying to understand that side of things.
If that is the case, that either the virus has tickled the immune system and it stayed locked on in some way, or the virus is hiding somewhere and tickling the immune system from a covert hiding place, possibly the gut. In either scenario, the immune system is overactive. What can we do to turn it off?
So this is why the mechanism is so important, because you might approach those in completely different ways. If you're harboring a small amount of virus somewhere in your body, you might actually be able to treat long COVID by giving people antivirals. Alternatively, if it's autoimmune, an antiviral is going to do absolutely nothing. And actually what you want to do is to give people some sort of immunosuppressant. I have heard that there are clinical studies looking at both of those, but I haven't seen any convincing results one way or the other yet. But that is obviously something that people are very excited by.
Do you think this phenomenon is unique, A, to SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID? Would other coronaviruses do this? Or, more broadly, might all viruses be capable of doing this? So if we had a bad dose of flu, this could happen. And is it just that we got so many people all at once catching SARS-CoV-2 that it disclosed this phenomenon and it's always been there? We just didn't see it.
You've put it in better words than I could have right there. So yes, it's probably the case that you had this new virus. It turns up, no one has any immunity to it. Everybody gets sick all at once. And so you get this big wave of people with what we call like post-viral syndromes. They're just sick for long periods of time after the virus. There is evidence from SARS-CoV-1, commonly called SARS, that was an outbreak that happened in East Asia, particularly South Korea and Japan and China back in 2003. There were patients there who got sick at the time and they were reporting years later that they still didn't feel better. I have seen some evidence that flus can do this. They had a patient who got Spanish flu in 1919 and was still sick into the 1920s and they just didn't know what to do with this person. So yeah, there's this view now that maybe all viruses cause this. And if you have a brand new virus that springs across from animals and then causes a pandemic, you're going to get a big wave of post-viral illness. And of course, that's very worrying because we expect there will eventually be another pandemic. And so trying to understand long COVID now might help prepare us for the next one.
Ben Krishna there. Notwithstanding some of these positive developments in our understanding of long COVID, a one-size-fits-all treatment for the various ways it manifests in people is therefore unlikely to materialise. And it's a problem that could be with us for many years to come. In the meantime, though, some of those living with long COVID feel forgotten among the medical professionals who were on the front line of the pandemic response. Doctors like Natalie McDermott, whom we heard from earlier, feel that they were offered insufficient protection for the danger they were exposed to, and some, like her, are now living with debilitating long-term health problems that impact on their ability to do the job they were originally trained for.
Can you do your job still? Because you were on the wards looking after little kids. Can you still do that?
Not really, or not in the way I did before. I would like to keep doing that, but even just to complete my training, which I've just finished, has really cost me from a health perspective. So I might be able to do the research side of my job, provided I can get more funding, but the actual full-time clinical component is very difficult for me. I'm looking at maybe moderated job plans, but I can't be the doctor I was hoping to be. And I also am very passionate about disaster and epidemic response. And, well, I'm just not convinced that many organisations would want to send me out to a disaster zone right now.
If you can't do your job that you've been training to do, you're aspiring to do and you were good at, does this mean that you basically can't practice? How is the NHS or your employer looking after you? Because you were effectively being exposed to a threat. You've ended up with this problem, almost certainly because of that threat, and succumbed to damage because of it. What do they say?
Well, unfortunately, not a lot, really. The problem is that because I've come to the end of my training, whilst I was in training, obviously there was some degree of protection to help me get to the end of my training. But as with any doctor, when they finish their training, they then need to apply for consultant posts. And it's very difficult for me to apply for a consultant post because I need modifications in place to do that. So essentially, I'm applying for a job that I know I can't do without adaptations and modifications to the job plan. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Otherwise, I can continue in research and I can apply for research funding. But so far, I haven't been very successful at that either.
But is there nothing occupationally that you can do? Because if I succumb to an injury at work, then I have a reasonable expectation that someone will make good on that.
Well, I think that the problem is that at the moment, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between who made the decisions about the personal protective equipment we were provided with. I think a lot of people don't realise that many of us were working on COVID wards with nothing but a surgical mask. I found it ironic that there would be people on the underground who had better PPE on than we were given working with known cases of COVID. But no one will quite acknowledge the decision-making chain that brought about the blanket policy on PPE. And I believe that our employer had a duty of care to protect us as best they could. I mean, nothing is 100%, but as best they could, and that they failed in that regard. But unfortunately, until we get a clear understanding of the pathway of decision making and why those decisions were made, it's very difficult to challenge. But we are now trying to take legal action on behalf of all healthcare workers who may have been very negatively affected by this virus to try and get those answers, as well as for some of my colleagues who are unable to work at all, to find some kind of compensation for them because they've lost their careers and their livelihoods.
So there's a bigger cost to living with long COVID than just the direct health impacts, as is clear there. Our thanks again to Natalie McDermott. And we approached NHS England to see if someone was available to speak to us. They told us long COVID remains a new and complex condition, and it is important we continue to build an evidence base of proven interventions that can support people to manage their symptoms and aid recovery. They go on to say the NHS has established over 100 specialist post-COVID services across England, which offer a range of specialist multidisciplinary support in managing and treating the physical and psychological impacts of long COVID. If you're concerned about ongoing symptoms following COVID-19, please speak to your GP team. Meanwhile, might yoga have a therapeutic role to play in helping to rehabilitate people with long COVID? Well, many extol the virtues, so we sent along James Titko to the Yoga for Life Project's Claire Wally for some tips on his breathing.
In March 2020, my husband got COVID, and it became apparent that he wasn't getting better from it. And it was so early that the word long COVID hadn't been coined at that stage. One thing he really was struggling with was chest pain and his breathing. And so I decided to set up a breathing class. And we quite quickly got a lot of people joining this. It was initially through word of mouth, and it was on Zoom. And I was teaching really people how to breathe properly, possibly for the first time, in that we're never taught that. And it's very common for people who have had COVID to get something called breathing pattern disorder, where you breathe using your upper respiratory muscle, so the upper part of the chest, and out through your mouth rather than breathing in and out of your nose and into your belly. And in correcting that, you switch on your vagus nerve, which in turn switches on your parasympathetic nervous system, your system of rest and digest.
It's a very interesting thought, teaching people to breathe properly, something we obviously all do unconsciously in order to stay alive. I'm intrigued, Claire. Can you give me a taste?
Okay. So you can do this practice lying down, seated or standing. But if you're doing it seated, if you bring your feet underneath your knees are hip width apart, and you just feel down into the four corners of your feet. And so that you start to feel really centered and stable, you should very gently inhale, draw the shoulders up to your ears. And then as you exhale, dropping your shoulders down your back, root down through the four corners of your feet, the sitting bones, and reach up tall through the crown of your head. And just start to feel this sensation of space in the front body. And now very gently place one hand on your belly, the other hand onto your chest, and perhaps close your eyes or take a soft gaze. Start to come into your feeling body and observe where you're feeling the breath in your body. And if you're feeling the breath in the upper hand, you're breathing using the upper respiratory muscles. And we want to descend the breath now down into the lower hand. So very gently start to breathe into the lower hand, feeling the breath expand with the belly. And as you exhale, feel the navel drawing back towards your spine. And then inhaling, belly rising, exhaling, belly falling. And keep going with this breathing practice. And when you start to observe some stillness in the upper hand, drop that hand down onto the lower hand. Keep focusing on that breath, feeling the breath going in and out of the nose and in the belly. And return to your gentle smile. And perhaps just take a moment to observe whether you feel different how you did at the start of the practice.
Oh, Claire, that was wonderful. And I was able to take part in that brief exercise while sitting down. I presume while yoga is not an extremely sort of vigorous exercise, it still takes some aerobic strength. Is that an accommodation, therefore, that you've made to bring this to people with all sorts of presentations?
Yes, yes. So it's important that what we teach people can do also lying down and from a bed. So the yoga we teach, aside from the breath, it's very, very calm and restful. There are lots of pauses. And we also encourage people, if they're really fatigued or it's difficult for them to do, is instead of doing it, visualize themselves doing it, because there's a certain amount of research to show that this also can have physiological benefits.
The calming voice of Claire Wally there from the Yoga for Life project. Despite all you've heard today about the extremely serious illnesses that some people living with long COVID experience after infection with SARS-CoV-2, there is still nevertheless a stigma around it. And perhaps that's because, as we've heard, it's such a difficult thing to define. But scientists are tirelessly probing the pathology of long COVID, and there are, thankfully, some green shoots beginning to emerge. We encourage you to get in touch with us to describe your experiences, and please do keep the conversation going. Our email address, chris@thenakedscientist.com. That's it for this week. Do stay tuned for our weekly roundup of science news this Friday, and be sure to join us next Tuesday when we're going to talk ticks. Searching for the source of the rise in tick-related diseases, to be precise. We hope you'll join us then. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith, and from everyone here at the Naked Scientist team, thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.